Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 95. Stan and Oily, a geopolitical tragicomedy, part 2. Once again, reading from Pepe Escobar's epic book, Globalistan, published by Nimble Books. And he's a columnist, writes a column for, posted at Asia Times and elsewhere, The Roving Eye. His bio there reads, an extreme traveler, Pepe's nose for news has taken him to all parts of the globe. He was in Afghanistan and interviewed the military leader of the anti-Taliban Northern Alliance, Ahmad Shah Massoud, a couple of weeks before his assassination. 2 weeks before September 11, 2001, while Pepe was in the tribal areas of Pakistan, ATOL published his prophetic piece, Get Osama Now or Else. Pepe was one of the first journalists to reach Kabul after the Taliban's retreat, and more recently, he has explored and reported from Iraq, Iran, Central Asia, U.S., and China. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Interestingly, started another book, which looks to be an amazing book, called Grabbing Back, Essays Against the Global Land Grab. This editor would add, and for Mother Earth. But anywho, there's a large representation of indigenous, not about large, but a good amount, looking at the index. Anyway, the segue was just reading about some history in the 1800s, and mentioning Europe, the people of Europe revolted against the ruthless bourgeoisie. So that reminded of just having talked about last week, the nomad elite, the ruthless bourgeoisie and the nomad elite. Now I'd have to know more to know exactly if that's the same, but it sure sounds like it, and reminds of that famous phrase that not much changes along those lines anyway. So jumping in again with, here's chapter 3, Pipelinistan, way forward. This was an interesting bit, again showing how the a lot of times the resources are protected by the military. He's talking about the BTC pipeline, and then he says, "But at least protection at the end of BTC in Ceyhan, Turkey, is guaranteed. It's not a coincidence that the pipeline ends right next door to the massive American air base at Incirlik. As oil geopolitics goes, BTC is a key component in the U.S.'s overall strategy of trying to wrestle the Caucasus and Central Asia away from Russia and bypassing Iranian oil and gas routes." And then a little bit further on, BTC was only officially inaugurated in July 2006 in a big party in Istanbul. Israel's energy ministry was represented. Israel imports 30% of its oil from Azerbaijan. 3 months earlier, Turkey and Israel had announced their joint plan to build four underwater pipelines for oil and gas, but also for water from the Tigris and Euphrates and electricity, bypassing both Syria and Lebanon. The overall strategy by then was clear. The U.S., Azerbaijan, Turkey, Israel alliance controlling a key Pipelinistan node of oil and gas to the eastern Mediterranean, now linked to the Caspian, with the intention of exporting at least a substantial amount back to Asia, thus bypassing once again Russia and Iran. And remember, this is from 7, 8 years ago, this book. Officially, BTC would only channel oil to Western markets, but with Ceyhan soon to be linked to the Trans-Israel Eilat Ashkelon pipeline, Israel can also become a key player, re-exporting Caspian crude from the Red Sea to Asia. This node will be in direct competition with Caspian exports via Russia and Iran. What? That made me laugh because that does sound like Laurel and Hardy type of stuff. At this sort of in a geopolitical way, this like bunch of people trying to control the pipeline going one way, and then another people trying to control it the other way, and indirectly, things going on, trying to go underwater and on land and wherever they can. Amazing. And then another interesting section. All over the Islamic world, as well in most of Western Europe and East Asia, there were few doubts that Osama bin Laden's presence in Afghanistan on 9/11 provided the ultimate excuse for Washington to install a cluster of military bases in Central Asia and the Trans-Caucasus, a former Soviet sphere. Thus, the quote, "war on terror" was never about a clash of civilizations between Islam and the West, much less terrorism. The name of the game from the beginning has been Pipelinistan. Monster oil corporatistan, profits to be made by controlling Central Asia, Caspian oil and gas, bypassing both Russia and Iran, and exerting pressure on China. And he refers to the grand chessboard theory of, however you pronounce his name, Zbigniew Brzezinski in the late 1990s, where he sort of outlined the strategy of what's going on now, the political chessboard. Yeah, this is so chocked with the info. It just astounds me, even looking it over again after reading the book. This line, Brzezinski was a BP consultant during the Bill Clinton years, that revolving door that we've seen so much. In 1995, he went to Baku himself on behalf of Clinton to propel what would become BTC. Brzezinski also sat on the board of the U.S.-Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, whose chairman in Washington was the president of ExxonMobil Exploration. Other members of the board included the ubiquitous Henry Kissinger and James Baker III, who in 2003 went to Tbilisi to tell Shevardnadze his reign was over. Dick Cheney was also a board member before he became vice president. And then another little section, Putin's pipeline chess. He mentions that Gazprom, Gazprom, with its headquarters in Moscow, accounts for no less than 25% of world gas production. It's the world's largest natural gas company. It's 8% of Russia's GDP. And he's got there's a whole chapter towards later on in the book, the Gazprom nation and its, quote, near abroad. The near abroad gets explained. And again, he has BTC will carry Caspian crude to Western Europe, while the Iranian route would initially carry Caspian Sea crude to Asia. So, amazing. And the 1,500-kilometer-long pipeline from Tengiz in the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea port of Novorossiysk is the single largest American investment in the Caspian. The main client is inevitably Tengiz Chevroil, owned by Chevron 50%, ExxonMobil 25%, and Russia and Kazakh partners 25%. Boy, that yeah, that again, like I said last show about the veneer of the nation, you know, nation countries and nations having these, you know, the business transcends or goes under the name. And here we have, you know, this oil owned by Chevron and ExxonMobil. It's not even just those individually. And then Russia and Kazakh partners, who knows who that is? And he goes on to say, Kazakhstan is arguably per capita the richest country in the whole planet, not only because of oil and gas, but because it inherited more than 60% of all former Soviet mineral resources, at least 80 different types of minerals. In spite of all that, roughly 56% of their 15 million citizens remain poor and invisible to the ballet of Mercedes and Audis of the oil oligarchs in Almaty. Annual GDP per capita is still a meager US $3,000. The average Kazakh on a salary of US $50 a month still has to quay up under the snow waiting for a bus. There you get Pepe's compassion coming through, along with the amazing writing. Turkmenistan is the third largest producer and the second largest exporter of natural gas in the world. And from an administrative and political point of view, the former USSR identified Central Asia to four republics: Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, which corresponded to the Persian Transoxiana and to the Arab Beyond the River. And in a section called Who Will Profit from Iraq's Oil, in pure liquid war fashion, Iraq was starved and decimated by 12 years of UN sanctions. It was shocked and awed into oblivion. Then one of its provisional governments on the road to democracy asked the IMF, i.e., an arm of the US Treasury Department, for a US $685 million loan to rebuild what the US shocked and awed. The IMF, true to form, inevitably forced Iraq to scrap oil subsidies and privatize the economy. With unemployment at around 70%, the only way millions of Iraqis were surviving was thanks to food and fuel subsidies. The IMF's structural adjustment also means, on a much serious scale, the dismantling of essential social services in Iraq, where under Saddam, oil money paid for some of the best hospitals and universities in the Middle East. For instance, my translator during the 2003 U.S. invasion was a bright young Jordanian whose father had sent him to study civil engineering in Baghdad. And a little bit further on, Syria closed the pipeline Kirkuk-Bynas in 1982 when it was supporting Iran in the war against Iraq. That's why Israel wants regime change in Damascus to build one of two pipelines, either a Mosul-Haifa pipeline or a section linking Haifa to a reopened Kirkuk-Bynas. Now, those are names that are cropping up again in the Iraq news. I mentioned the jihadist, or whatever they are, ISIS, formerly called ISIS, more recently called IS, is supposedly had taken over Mosul. And here's, like, you know how much, like, ExxonMobil and some of the oil companies there just, like, have made the hugest profits ever anywhere in history. And here's a clue why. Big oil astronomic profits for big oil only apply when big oil controls oil fields, and new oil fields are getting scarcer by the day. From super giant fields like Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, 5 million barrels a day, and Kashagan in Kazakhstan, to their smaller cousins. It's by owning oil fields that ExxonMobil's 2005 profit can reach US$32 billion, the largest single profit in the history of corporatistan, the U.S. branch. Here's another showing, you know, where amidst all the info, where Pepe's leanings and real vision is. Wishful thinking would see harmony between Russia, Iran, the U.S., and China, all engaged in a sensible exploitation of Central Asia's natural wealth. This would lead to economic development everywhere and eventually more political freedom. It doesn't look like it's going to be this way. The perception in Islam, in the Chinese universe, and in the Russian sphere is that the U.S. used and continues to use the long war to exclusively advance its own strategic oil and gas interests. This is a recipe for disaster. The China, Russia, Iran, India, Asian energy security grid is a decisive counterpunch to Washington's global ambitions. Again, that's this almost that exact line has been popping up in the news recently, and one of the things I'm learning from reviewing all this is sometimes when Just the whole transitional phase of the going from renewable, the fossil fuel era to the renewables. It's sobering to see that, all that that's going on. And perhaps the idealist optimistic view is that sort of watershed moment, the price of solar panels or whatever goes way down, all of a sudden everybody's doing it. That could be an unseen shift, but along these geopolitical lines, it looks like there's a lot of stuff that's not looking so pretty. But as I say, we shall see. In A Corporatist Hand, the Dubai Post-Oil Dream, Chapter 4, that, it was quite a picture of Dubai. I had seen online years ago, they showed the picture was of an indoor ski slope, and the question was, where is this place? And you'd think, I mean, you'd wonder why indoors, whatever, but you'd think someplace cold, and it turned out to be Dubai, which is a desert. hot stuff. Dubai is not really a city-state. It's corporatistan as family business. Only five families control the whole United Arab Emirates. Call it Singapore Plus, a fact confirmed after a visit by Singapore's resident Confucius and founding father Lee Kuan Yew. Behind CEO Sheikh Al Maktoum are three technocrats responsible for what is called Project Dubai. The trio has their offices at the sleek Emirates Tower, constantly voted best business hotel in the Middle East. And oh, there's a long section here I highlighted. This is good stuff in Pepe language here. A hotel developer is building a fake lost city of Atlantis. Fake scuba diving sites, the Maldives, the Barrier Reef, the Caymans, the Red Sea are also part of the package. 7,000 South Asians work on one of the palms. Instead of causing what would be a perennial traffic jam, every day they are ferried from further along the coast. In another one of the palms, there will be houses on stilts, which, seen from above, will spell out a poem written by who else? The Crown Prince. Quote, "Heed the wisdom of the wise. It takes a man of vision to write on water. Not everyone who rides a horse is a jockey. Great men rise to great challenges." End quote. Poem. Quote, "In the early 2000s, Dubai Internet City was literally desert sand. 5 years later, it housed the Middle East headquarters of every major global IT company. For the multinational shop till you drop brigades, the Mall of the Emirates bills itself as the largest outside the U.S. and the third largest in the world. And that includes the only artificial ski resort in the whole Middle East. It looks like a freak, twisted steel tube standing out in the Dubai skyline. At the monster Souq Madinat Jumeirah, everything is fake. It's a fake souk inside a fake medina with its own five-star hotels and apartments crisscrossed by fake water channels. Ibn Battuta, the legendary Muslim navigator, died and was reborn as a mall, complete with fake Ibn Battuta medieval sailing ships and, quote, Chinese, Indian, Persian, or Moroccan, end quote, halls. The Giorgio Armani Hotel and the Palazzo Versace are coming, and so is a U.S. $500 million underwater hotel, a chess city, 32 tower blocks of 64 floors, each in the form of a chess piece, an apartment tower shaped like the Big Ben, an aviation city with its cargo village, an aid city come humanitarian free zone, an exhibition city, a festival city, a healthcare city, a flower city. There's also Dubai Land, the U.S.'s 4.5 billion Arab Disneyland, which will be bigger than Monaco, providing jobs for at least 300,000 people. There's the new urban railway with 37 stops, the U.S.'s 1.7 billion silicone oasis for the IT giants. Internet City is now passé. And the U.S. 6 billion Dubai waterfront Arabian Canal, bigger than Barbados. Meanwhile, what has been built for the people of Baghdad? U.S. military bases and the largest U.S. embassy fortress in the world. No wonder the ultimate psychedelic night drive in Dubai is to glide along the ghosts of giant buildings buried in the desert sand, all surrounded by a myriad of scaffolding and overhung by giant tower cranes. It's like watching a glowing, larger-than-life steel and glass equivalent of the buried terracotta army of Emperor Qin in Xian. Now, let's meet the slaves. The social pyramid in Dubai is unforgiving. At the base is your average construction worker, inevitably South Asian, either Pakistani or Indian. He is, of course, invisible. But he and his fellow workers now comprise an astonishing 80% of the UAE's population. Human Rights Watch has repeatedly denounced that this archetypal construction worker is never treated like a human being. For corporate Astan, UAE, this is irrelevant. Your average worker toils for a minimum of 12 hours a day and up to 50 degrees Celsius with a half an hour break 6 days a week and earns no more than US$150 a month. He lives in a camp, 4 and sometimes as many as 12 to a 15 square meter room lost in the dreary Al-Quaz industrial suburb. In his day off, exhausted, he watches Bollywood DVDs and catches up with news from home in the crowded Deir al-Souk. One night at the Emirates Tower in a standard room would consume 5 months of his salary. He can only come back home to see his family, who gets an average of 50% of his monthly salary every 2 years. If he's really lucky, or elderly expat, a former skilled worker, he may eke out a comfortable living as a taxi driver. He has no rights. Trade unions are banned. If he speaks up, he's instantly deported, or in desperation, he may follow the path of thousands who escape to massive slums crammed with illegal immigrants in neighboring Sharjah. If she's a woman and works as a maid or in a hotel, she can be sexually harassed, and there will be no consequences. Boy, intense stuff. Talks about, one more bit here. Dozens of construction workers died in 2005. Most of the Spider-Men of the Gulf simply fell from the huge new towers, as slings and ropes are not exactly high-tech. Boy. Anyway, it's quite the picture of Dubai, and here he ends the chapter with, Enron was a corporate Astan dream. It collapsed. Everyone knows the property market bubble will explode, and the stock market... If this is 2006, that was a couple years before the property market bubble exploded. And the stock market is bound to fall. The only question is when. The Dubai dream model of gated condo mega mall golf course designer food, preferably in an artificial island, may not be exactly Arabian Nights material or bound to be replicated in other parts of Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Strikes like in March 2006 by 2,500 workers at, of all places, Burj Dubai, the tallest tower in the world, will be replicated. The petrodollar dream remains attached to the absence of rights to most people building the dream. Without these invisibles, the dream would disappear like a mirage, as if all the oil wells turned dry. Gotta read that line again. The petrodollar dream remains attached to the absence of rights to most people building the dream. In the last paragraph of the chapter, Sheikh Zayed's and Sheikh Al-Maktoum's dream of modern Arabia will nonetheless continue to entice. Quagmire Iraq is not exactly an alternative, conforming the image of an apolitical, consumer-mad, citizenship-free society. Corporatistan at its apex. It's as if Dubai's ruling family had kept to heart the words of the late great Indonesian writer Pramoda Ananta Tour. Just as politics cannot be separated from life, life cannot be separated from politics. People who consider themselves to be non-political are no different. They've already been assimilated by the dominant political culture. They just don't feel it anymore. So that's the battles going on with the protecting of the land and resources, where indigenous peoples are on the front lines. This is more of in these sort of fake built-up cities, what it takes to build the corporate monoculture sort of elite in a way. It's not just McDonald's and gas stations. They're talking hotels and fancy stuff. So it's but interesting, the different people from different countries. It's a different, same sort of principle, but a bit of a different scenario. And that last line, that's really telling. Assimilated. Because by the dominant culture, they just don't feel it anymore. That speaks to the apathy that gets mentioned a fair amount. Oh yeah, that reminded too of I think Phoenix and Los Angeles, the energy to run and build up those cities has happened because of the taking of Peabody Coal. The whole, it's in the Navajo and Hopi lands, I think it is, both of them, perhaps. The slurrying of coal and what that's done to the it's a similar thing of the workers and the indigenous being abused and Mother Earth being desecrated so as to build up these These essentially cities out of nowhere. I mean, Phoenix is like a desert too. And to build this, to prop up this, this sort of high tech Disney World stuff. It's just, that's a whole that's like a whole show there. Could go off on a tangent. Chapter 5, Jihadistan, and that starts with a bunch of quotes. I'm also a fan of quotes, and he just chalks. He doesn't just put one quote at the beginning of the chapter. He loads it up. The first one is from the Holy Quran. Verily, never will Allah change the condition of a people until they change it themselves. And the second quote is from Iqbal Ahmad, the Jihad International Incorporated, 1988. The chickens of jihadis, once sponsored by imperialism and the state, have been coming home to roost. Afghanistan threatens to become a metaphor for the future. And then Paddy Chayefsky from the Movie Network. Diane Christensen, I am interested in doing a weekly dramatic series based on the Ecumenical Liberation Army. The way I see the series is each week we open with an authentic act of political terrorism taken on the spot in the actual moment. Then we go to the drama behind the opening film footage. That's your job, Ms. Hobbs. You've got to get the ecumenicals to bring in that film footage for us. The network can't deal with them directly. They are, after all, wanted criminals. And the fourth one, Sheikh Sahal al-Din Nasser, Imam of Al-Azbar in Cairo, September 2006. If Muslims close ranks and unite, no one in the world would dare to attack them and insult their religion and the Prophet. Those who accuse Islam of intolerance and violence are either ignorant or full of enmity. And he's got a line about Britain and France after the 1920s, after the betrayal of the Arab nation via the Sykes-Picot Agreement, where Britain and France carved up the Middle East for themselves. The heart of the Islamic world lost its unity, carved up by the West into small states. Up to the early 20th century, the caliphate in Istanbul would issue a passport to anyone declaring himself a Muslim. So yeah, that reminded me of the divide and conquer, and it's been written online now that that is some of the plan of Iraq, is to carve it up into a bunch of states, which I think is balkanizing, because I had heard that word so many times that I looked it up. And that's what I saw. And then, yeah, Pepe sometimes really makes me stop and think. He's got a line, a lead up to it. Meanwhile, modern Islam has to deal with terror tactics involving its name. High-tech terrorism, essentially a hardcore media war. Each attack is a thermonuclear media bomb. Whatever its actual magnitude, it has to register as an attack on the whole info-hungry world. Without propaganda, now in real time, terrorism would be totally irrelevant. Bombs may kill innocents, but their true lethal effect is in the frantic infosphere of accelerated media particles. And Al-Qaeda and all the other nodes of the Salafi jihadist or Islamist front have known this better than most. So yeah, there's that whole connection with the media and the sort of buzz, that people they've got from the internet, and how the information and videos can get spread, all the videos of Osama that were released, and never quite did a full study, but it was interesting over the years to kind of look at his faces. There had been some saying that, it was a different guy or an actor, or, somewhat, there's plenty of those looking types over there. No offense on that cliche. But yeah, that was interesting. And I remember looking this up. I wrote a poem about it. After 2001, jihada means to strive. And the way I understood it was, it was more of an internal. The real meaning of the jihad was an internal, sort of like the yoga or whatever spiritual path, that it's really one's own struggle, not an outward craziness. But this, again, Pepe puts an interesting thing in here to further explain. Jihad in Arabic literally means to struggle. There are two forms of jihad. The lesser jihad is linked to the defense of Islam and doctrinally allows the use of violence, but only if Islam is under attack by non-Muslims. In this case, every Muslim must adhere. A jihad can also be launched for the expansion of Islam. In this case, every Muslim must also adhere, but as an individual can contribute with goods, services, and cash, and not necessarily become a warrior. The greater jihad takes place inside each Muslim's soul. That's the jihad that really matters. These two jihads, against the enemy and against the ego, have always coexisted in Islam. Salafi jihadists emphasize that as the fight against a heretical adversary is an imperative, self-sacrifice is also a must. But in mystical Islam, the fight against the enemy is just an illusion, not far away from the Buddhist fight against the kingdom of Mara. What matters is inner purification on the way to mystical spirituality. Essentially, it's also what Lao Tzu formulated as to know others is wisdom, to know oneself is superior wisdom. Islam has always been convulsed by the tension between these two jihads. Sufis have been banned because of their mystical approach, but sometimes a theological master like the Ayatollah Khomeini promotes a fusion. For him, the unbounded love of Allah makes the martyr want to dissolve himself into him. Quite telling. Been wanting to do a book on Sufi, do a show on Sufi for a while, but the book I was reading is pretty dense, so I put it down some years ago, because that is one of my theories about the real, that, you know, I don't know that much about the Islam. I remember looking at the Quran some years ago, and it was, seemed like violent parts, but maybe that was translation. But anyway, the Sufism, the mysticism path, that interests me the most as like what's sort of a essence of out of the mainstream craziness spirituality in that area. And a bit more in this chapter. Jihad Inc. is an American invention along with associate executive directors Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan. It was U.S. strategy in USSR invaded Afghanistan in the 1980s. Let's launch 1 billion Muslims against the evil empire that catapulted jihad to the forefront of political Islam. And a bit more Pepe style coming in here. Not to be an outdone jack of all trades, and then most wanted man in the world, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was still alive, came up with his own reality TV show with Zarqawi's Omar Brigade showing off the capture and commenting on the execution of members of the Shiite Badr Brigades. The audience for this extreme sports lethal reality show was, of course, the amorphous, angry, impoverished, radicalized Middle Eastern masses. What next? Queer eye for the jihadi guy? Jihadi idol? Desperate jihadi wives? Reality TV, propaganda, infotainment, it's all in the same demented flux. Al-Qaeda profited handsomely from the remix with the spectacular timing, much more effective than 1,000 bombs of Osama's address right before the 2004 U.S. presidential elections. The Al-Qaeda remixed video dispensed with the Islamic phraseology, window dressing. This was the sheikh as statesman way above the terrorist fray, assuming the persona of a benevolent Abraham-like prophet in an Emmy-worthy performance, trying to patiently open the eyes of the 1.5 billion worldwide Islamic Ummah, that's pronouncing right, U-M-M-A, and almost 300 million Americans. And I guess this is talking about the people of Islam or associated with the Ummah. They see the West as ignoring, despising, or violently rejecting Islam. So they react with Islamism remixed, blending Westernization, hate of the West, the mythification of the original Muslim community, the utopian will to restore Islam to its past splendor, and the promotion of death as a martyr in jihad against a frightened West where people unlike them are incapable of dying. Why a suicide bomber is so powerful? Because he represents a challenge to Western technical, economic, and military superiority. A martyr may claim ritualized sacred death as his victory. I'm going to read that again because there's so many he gives. They see the West as ignoring, despising, or violently rejecting Islam, so they react with Islamism remixed, blending Westernization, hate of the West, the mythification of the original Muslim community, the utopian will to restore Islam to its splendor, and the promotion of death as a martyr in a jihad against a frightened West. Anyhow, that's shows you the motivations can run complicated. Just like Washington neocons, Al-Qaeda seems to be engaged in regime change, fighting to place rulers, especially in the Arab world, who do not clash with its political ambitions, even if such leaders don't subscribe to Al-Qaeda's worldview. And a page or two more here in this chapter. Amidst all this drama intervened the most spectacular plot twist. Al-Qaeda didn't see it coming, and will take a long time to react. Suddenly, Al-Qaeda had become a minor player in the Salafi jihadist constellation, and even minor player among the 1.5 billion Ummah in terms of how to fight back against the hegemony of the West. Hezbollah, the most sophisticated guerrilla movement in the world, showed the way. In reality, Showtime, during the summer of 2006, Israel-Hezbollah asymmetric war. The contrast of a Shiite resistance movement enjoying broad popular support with the cultish, isolated bunch of Salafi jihadists could not be starker. In the top five of the most popular leaders of the Arab world, Al-Qaeda was already losing ground to the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas in Palestine. Now it was positively blown out of the court by the Iranian leadership and especially Hezbollah's Sheikh Nasrallah, the new Nasser. Hezbollah imprinted its mark as fierce defender of Palestinian rights. The organization of Sunni Hamas is now modeled on Hezbollah. In the complex battle for hearts and minds of the Arab and wider Islamic worlds, moderates had assured a strategic victory with long-range repercussions. In Egypt and in Jordan, the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, the oldest, largest modern Islamist movement in the world, supported Hezbollah unconditionally. That meant it was supporting Hezbollah's patron, the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well. The Sunni-Shiite convergence, illustrating an overwhelming Shiite prestige revival, much to the chagrin of Salafi jihadists and the House of Saad. Now, there's so much going on there. I have to read that. I'd have to study that. It gets tangled with the countries and the sects and the you know, etc. Plenty of Sunnis may still dream of the improbable return to the caliphate, but at the same time, they simply can't get enough of Shiite discipline and organization. In the summer of 2006, Muslim Brotherhood scholars, almost in awe, stressed that Hezbollah could be finally offering the model for an Islamic state. Sheikh Yusuf al-Qardawi publicly regretted there was no Hezbollah in Egypt, Jordan, and the wider Arab world. But this ain't no honeymoon. Shiites won't easily forget the thuggish Zarqawi cipher calling for their extermination in Iraq. Salafi jihadists do regard Shiites as apostates, but there are conditionalities. The original Al-Qaeda never attacked Shiites per se. The last couple of paragraphs. Al-Qaeda's ideology, as transfigured by al-Zawahiri, rules that the priority is to get rid of the faraway enemy, the U.S. After the U.S. abandons occupied Islamic lands, then the myriad problems inside Islam will be tackled. Essentially, this might be considered as the same agenda of the theocratic nationalist leadership in Tehran. The difference is the method. Iranians always argue successfully that Al-Qaeda's methods simply do not work because as you attack the U.S., the only political dividend you reap is even more American hegemony. It should not be forgotten that Osama himself, over the years, has deployed a full seduction strategy vis-a-vis the leadership in Tehran, to no avail. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini and the top Ayatollahs in QOM regard the 1979 Islamic Revolution as the undisputed vanguard of Islam. Obviously, Al-Qaeda simply cannot match it, especially with all those dodgy CIA connections. Whatever Al-Qaeda's and Salafi jihadists' next move and whatever jihadistan's new tactics, the ultimate choice for the Middle East is not between secular dictatorship and secular democracy. It's between U.S.-backed secular dictatorship of the Mubarak kind and Islamic democracy, such as Hamas winning elections in Palestine, Hezbollah participating in Lebanon's government. What the people of the Middle East want and what Washington insists they want will always amount to a clash of different galaxies. It will remain so until the U.S. and triad member EU as well allow the Middle Eastern masses to choose what they really want to do with their future. What a concept. That was me. That was the edit of my comment. And then Pepe wraps it up. This is not going to happen, at least for the next generations, because of all that oil. Thus, we're all left once again suffering the appalling consequences of liquid and viscous war. Well, hopefully we're not all suffering and that we find ways to, to deal with whatever it is, whether it's a simple thing of what the weekly gas oil bill to run the car, you know, what that adds up to. Hopefully people find a way to, in their own small way, make peace with it and find ways to unplug as much from the system, because ultimately that's, in a lot of ways, it seems minuscule, but that fits the oil fuels, no pun intended, the buying of the oil fuels, and this faraway demand for oil. And that's when I start to think again of the inverted totalitarianism and how this
chaos that is stirred abroad is essentially, feeding the fix of the major oil government players, which in effect is feeding, our fix. I mean, you just go to, at least around this area, just whatever suburban main road corner, it's like there'll be a stretch for a while of no gas stations, but then, there's four at one intersection or so, and then, sometimes it seems like four, maybe two, but then another two, and it's just, to me, that's it's over the top when you think about it. But that's what keeps things humming in that system. So again, perhaps that threshold moment where something changes, and that can really change the demand for all that, and which would in fact change stuff. There was a interesting article online recently about the advance of renewables, and saying that by 2030 or so, there would be a large progress in renewables, solar and wind especially. But it's sort of like a tug, because China and India are going kind of Western culture, concrete, get your car and your blender crazy. And it's like, what? But they're using, China's using a large percent of renewables, but also it's like a fossil fuel. It's like the tortoise and the hare kind of thing with the fossil fuels. And so it's this, progress going on, but yet still this dance of what will win out and when. So that wraps it up for this show. That's about a little over 100 pages into the book, up to chapter 6, which is Osamastan. So there's much more to come, perhaps in sequence, or perhaps something else will be interspersed. Anyway, thank you once again for listening, and be peaceful and have a good one. I'm going to read a short poem before the outro song. This poem was written a while back after I had been reading in the news the word jihad over and over, and wanted to see what it meant. Looked up the root. Jihada means to strive. And this poem is from my book, Impeach the Monsters, New Dawn, Poems and Essays. Jihada, to strive. The tiny fisted buds of cherry blossoms begin to show their fingers. How unviolently spring holds its own, bunched tight as a knot, only bearing to become itself. This is nature's jihad, overcoming anachronism, understanding the hallucinatory, finding a way to attain fullness without so much as harming a blade of grass. And this is a rendition of Old Man River, the Real Pipelines, part of the Mother Earth. And this is from Milton Nascimento, Brazilian singer, songwriter, musician.
Mm-hmm.